top story, Russia says NATO's adoption of a new strategy against Moscow shows the confrontational nature of the Western military alliance. China hits back at the U.S. president's comments about protecting Taiwan, saying Beijing has no room for concessions when it comes to its core interests. Also ahead, tens of thousands of Americans or American workers have walked off their jobs or are set to strike amid a tightening labor market. We'll have a report from Washington, D.C. Welcome to the program. Tensions escalating between Russia and the West. The Kremlin says NATO's adoption of a new strategy against Moscow shows that the military alliance has been created for confrontation. The Kremlin also defended an earlier Russian decision to sever ties with NATO, saying it was correct. Moscow says under these conditions, there is no need for a dialogue. This week, NATO defense ministers agreed a new master plan focusing on Russia. They said the plan aims to defend against what they called any potential Russian attack on multiple fronts. In addition to that, the Western military alliance accused 8 Russians of spying and expelled them. In a tit-for-tat move, Russia cut relations by shutting its diplomatic mission to NATO and the alliance's mission in Moscow. China has called on the United States to act cautiously over the Taiwan issue as tensions escalate between Washington and Beijing over the self-ruled island.
We urge the U.S. to strictly abide by the One China principle and the 3 joint communiques. The U.S. should act and speak cautiously on the Taiwan issue and refrain from sending wrong signals to separatist forces in Taiwan to avoid seriously damaging Sino-U.S. relations and peace and stability in the Taiwan Strait.
The official said China has no room for compromise on issues involving its core interests, including sovereignty and territorial integrity. That all came after U.S. President Joe Biden said his country has a commitment to defend Taiwan in case of a Chinese attack. China considers Taiwan as part of its territory. The island says it's an independent country. Tensions have escalated recently over Chinese military flights as well as increased U.S. military support for Taiwan. Just 2 weeks ago, U.S. media reports revealed that American forces had been secretly training Taiwanese troops for months. Political commentator Jason Androa says the U.S. is using Taiwan's push for independence as a tool to put pressure on China to advance its agenda in the region.
Taiwan stands as a very useful place for the United States. They can always prop up Taiwan as some kind of alternative example to whatever's going on in mainland China. It's also a very important military strategic point. Now, obviously, anytime you have a superpower like the United States, there is always a placing of weapons near enemies. This was previously done by the United States with Turkey aiming nuclear weapons at the Soviet Union. This is very much a continuation of that very policy. I mean, this is something that empires do. This gives the U.S. a justification for having its navy very close to Chinese waters, if not, depending on how close the actual 2 countries are. Because they can always say, well, our ships are docked at an ally's port, so we have a right to be there, etc. This is something that's been going on for some time now.
U.S. labor is back in the public eye as several unions representing tens of thousands of workers have walked off their jobs or just voted to authorize it. Wyatt Reed is in Washington, D.C.
A specter is haunting America, the specter of Striketober. Upwards of 100,000 workers across the U.S. are either currently on strike or potentially just weeks away from it, amid a historic wave of labor actions that's taken the country by storm. 35,000 nurses and healthcare workers have voted to authorize a strike against healthcare giant Kaiser Permanente. 60,000 Hollywood crew members seem headed for a strike amid widespread rank-and-file disapproval of a deal negotiated by union management. And thousands of workers elsewhere have already walked off.
Last week, 10,000 UAW members in warehouse and production jobs at John Deere started currently what is the biggest strike happening in the country. We have 2,000 CWA nurses in Buffalo and 1,400 Kellogg workers. They're also out on strike. About 1,000 mine workers in Alabama have been on strike at Warrior Met Coal since this past April.
These are just some of over a dozen labor actions brewing across the country. As executives have seen profits soar amid the COVID-19 pandemic, workers are insisting on their own piece of the pie. And with supply chain issues plaguing distribution and now hiring signs popping up left and right, they're wielding historic leverage to secure the raises and benefits they say management has been withholding for too long.
There is a tight labor market. Workers are fed up with being mistreated. We have, you know, the most pro-union president ever, potentially even more than FDR. We have a union leader at the Department of Labor who is heading the Department of Labor. Positive union sentiment in polls are the highest it's been in a very long time. Labor has a lot of leverage, and this critical moment is not going to last forever.
With the wind at their backs, many workers say it's time to press their advantage and lock in the wage increases and workplace improvements that have been steadily eroded by decades of neoliberal governance and attacks on organized labor. And with no real sense for just how long this window of opportunity will last, they say it's time to strike while the iron is hot. Wyatt Reed, Washington.
A U.S. judge has ruled that the U.S. government has no legal basis for holding an Afghan man at its Guantanamo Bay prison in Cuba. Ruling sets the stage for the potential release of Ansarullah Harun Gol 5 years after his lawyers filed a petition. They argued that his detention was unlawful. Gol has been held in the notorious U.S. prison since 2007 when he was captured in Afghanistan. He remained in custody without charge and was denied access to a lawyer for the first 9 years of his detention. Gol is one of the 13 men who have been cleared by the Military Review Board for release. Some have had clearances for years but are still held in Guantanamo prison. U.S. President Joe Biden has promised to close the notorious facility that has drawn criticism over the tactics and torture used against inmates. Commentator Jahangir Mohammad says the U.S. is responsible for all crimes committed at the Guantanamo prison, should be held accountable.
Well, I think this is one of the legacies of the last 20 years and the war on terror, which put around 800 people in this particular extrajudicial facility detention center. It's pretty clear that the United States is responsible for the facility and whatever's happened. And obviously the United Nations takes some responsibility because they have allowed this situation to go on. The reality is that the international order doesn't exist to hold the powerful to account.
A new survey has showed that the Eurozone economic recovery is losing steam amid rising prices caused by a supply chain crisis. The survey was conducted by the London-based information provider IHS Market. It says the Purchasing Managers Index slipped to 54.3 this month. The figure was above 56 and at 59 points in September and August, respectively. The study says the Eurozone could falter in the near term as the pandemic continues to disrupt economies and push prices higher. Things do not seem good in the UK either. Based on official data, retail sales volumes dropped for a fifth month in a row during September. The slump is blamed on a fuel crisis that has led to delays in shipping goods and high prices. Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement says its prisoners held in Israeli jails have ended their hunger strike after reaching an agreement with prison authorities. Movement has provided no details about the agreement that said the prisoners' demands have been met, hailing it as a victory for all the Palestinian people. Islamic Jihad also called the victory a turning point in the struggle against Israel. Some 400 members of the movement are currently in Israeli jails. More than half of them went on a hunger strike on October the 13th to protest punitive measures imposed on them. The protest, or I should say the measures, followed the escape of six Palestinian inmates from a high-security Israeli jail last month. All were later recaptured. Some were put in solitary confinement. Israelis have begun the construction of new settler units in the occupied West Bank city of Hebron, also known as Al-Khalil. The project, which was approved by Israeli authorities 4 years ago, includes building 31 settler units in a military base. An Israeli anti-settlement group known as Peace Now has launched a legal action to stop the construction of the new settlement. It says the project is the first major expansion of Israeli settlements in the city in 2 decades. Palestinian residents in Al-Khalil say the new neighborhood would result in an increase in violence and consequently more restrictions on them. About 1,000 Israeli settlers live in Al-Khalil under heavy military protection among more than 200,000 Palestinians. All Israeli settlements are illegal under international law. Rabbi David Feldman says Israel's settlement expansion in the occupied Palestinian territories is a crime against humanity. Is a crime that is against humanity.
This illegal settlement movement is just expanding and expanding and just pushing out the Arabs and just making all these problems and all this misery, all this serious oppression that the Palestinian people faced already for decades, just getting worse and worse. And happens to be that the settler issue is something that the entire world, even those who might agree with Israel to a certain extent, realize and admit that this is internationally wrong, this is a crime, and this is wrong. There is no excuse. There's no excuse to the entire occupation, but certainly not to the settlement expansion.
Russia has reported its highest COVID-19 infections and deaths in a single day since the start of the pandemic. The country on Friday registered over 37,000 new cases in 24 hours. Russia's new daily deaths were 1,064, marking the fourth straight day of record fatalities. Neighboring Ukraine logged record 24-hour infections and deaths as well. It registered more than 23,000 new infections and over 600 new deaths. The disease has been surging there in recent weeks, despite tighter restrictions announced last month. COVID is surging in other countries in Eastern Europe as well. Romania has hit the world's highest death rate per capita last week. Latvia has entered another nationwide lockdown to battle the virus. The fate of the 2015 nuclear deal between Iran and several world countries hanging in the balance, with major issues still remaining unresolved after several rounds of negotiations. However, given the speculations that a new round of talks might be on the cards for the revival of the deal in Vienna, Tehran says it is not backing down from its position and is sticking to its demands.
6 years have passed since Iran and several states, namely the US, China, Russia, Britain, France, and Germany, put their signatures to a deal under which Tehran agreed to limit some of its nuclear activities in exchange for sanctions relief. But in 2018, the situation reached a deadlock when former U.S. President Donald Trump backed out of the deal. Not only that, but he also brought back the sanctions despite Iran's display of full compliance. Tehran waited for 1 year before finally cutting back on some of its commitments under the deal. Later on, with the administration of Joe Biden sweeping into power and the White House's declared willingness to return to the negotiating table, Tehran and the remaining signatories went back to the Austrian capital with an agenda to revive the landmark accord. Initially, some progress was made, but long-running issues remain unresolved to this day. In the meantime, the U.S. continues to keep the sanctions in place as a tool of pressure against Iran. Now, with the possibility of a renewed push for the revival of the deal, Tehran says it will not settle for anything less than results that would safeguard the rights of its people.
Iran is a country of dialogue and negotiation. But a negotiation that guarantees the rights of Iranian people and forces all parties to return to their commitments.
Iran has been sticking to one point, but Washington was the party to violate the deal and should therefore be the party to take the first step by returning to full compliance. Tehran says it will start resuming its commitment only after the complete removal of all U.S. sanctions in a verifiable manner. Action and not words. That's what Iran is demanding. It also says the European partners likewise need to put aside their empty promises and get back to action.
It was the inaction of the European states that emboldened Trump to withdraw from all agreements and violate JCPOA and Resolution 2231. That happened because the European capitals all acted as only passive observers. We were expecting that all sides come to Vienna with the full understanding that there is no shying away from their commitments, which should be fully implemented under the accord.
Iran is seeking reassurances from the European signatories that such violations would never happen again. It says any renegotiation of the terms of the deal is out of question. The administration of President Ebrahim Raisi is reviewing the details of the previous six rounds of discussions held in Vienna. Now, with speculations on the possible resumption of talks in the coming days and Tehran's firm stance, one can only speculate about how the other parties will fare up.
Sudanese have held a rally in the capital Khartoum against the current rulers, demanding a fully civilian government. Correspondent in Khartoum has more in this report.
Protesters took to the streets of the capital Khartoum, calling for protection of revolution and realization of its goals. Some reports say security forces attacked a group of demonstrators near the parliament headquarters. Saturday's rally came after a rival group rallied in support of the military leaders. Prime Minister Abdullah Hamadok emphasized earlier that Sudan is facing the worst and most dangerous crisis that threatens the transition and even threatens the entire country. Protesters say that the demonstration was orderly and peacefully chanted slogans calling for the completion of government institutions and a comprehensive reform that includes all state institutions. Following an aborted coup attempt on September 21st, tensions between Sudanese military and civilian leaders resurfaced. The military accused the civilian politicians of quarreling over positions, while civilians, members of the government, criticized the military leaders for claiming the sole right to lead the country through the transition period.
A huge number of people demonstrated around here, calling for the military to hand over the power to the civilian, as the Sudanese political arena divided between for and against the Sudanese government coalition. Muhammad Ali Fazari, Khartoum.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
November 25th, 2018. In a meeting with government officials of the Islamic Republic of Iran, ambassadors of Islamic countries and participants of the 32 Conference on Islamic Unity, practicing Islamic unity will allow Muslims to overcome all the schemes of the enemies of Islam. Today, the US is clearly weaker in the region than 10 or 20 years ago. Today, the vicious Zionist regime is clearly weaker than the past. A few years ago, the Zionist regime was defeated by the Hezbollah of Lebanon. It managed to resist for 33 days, and then the Zionist regime, was defeated. 2 years later, it managed to resist for 22 days, and then it was defeated by the Palestinians. And a few years after that, it managed to resist for 8 days against the oppressed people of Gaza, and then it was defeated. Just last week, it managed to resist for 2 days, and then it was defeated. This is the weakness of the Zionist regime. This is the increasing weakness of the Zionist regime.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The nations who have a certain thought, identity, and motivation are reliant on God. They rely on Allah, and Allah the Exalted will help them. If the unbelievers should fight you, they would certainly turn their backs. Then would they find neither protector nor helper. Such has been the practice of Allah already in the past. No change will you find in the practice of Allah. The Holy Quran, Surah 48, verses 22 to 23. This is the divine tradition. If Muslims stand firm, they will achieve victory over all the apparatuses of Taghuti and arrogant powers. Today, the people of Yemen are enduring the hardest tortures by the Saudi government, its followers, and the US, its main supporter. But you should know that the people of Yemen and Ansarullah will certainly be victorious. They will not be defeated. The people of Palestine will not be defeated. The only way is resistance. What has made the US so agitated today that it resorts to blather and wrong measures is the resistance of Muslim nations, and this resistance will produce results.
Midstream.
Samir Jaja's Lebanese forces thugs got themselves along with the entire country into a predicament by the malicious act of terrorism they committed last week in Beirut's Tayuni massacre. The ambush this militia conducted brought back the memories of all the genocidal massacres the Lebanese forces committed throughout the Lebanese civil war. However, this time, their misdeeds pushed to open the battle of liquidation of the American infiltrations into the state and its institutions. It is clear that Jaja hastened the security tensions and chose Ayn al-Rimayni versus al-Shiyah to awaken the memory of war and strife. This war criminal's higher goal is to drag the country into conflict to achieve his project of partition and confederation. The result? He will lose both goals and turn into a burden on the state, his Christian society, and the military establishment. He presented himself and his militia as a paranoid gang looking for chaos and security tensions. The ambush of Atayuni exposed Jaja's gang of terrorists. Reports of the officials of the Central Security Council confirmed the ambush, sniping, and the responsibility of the Lebanese forces known as UWIT. Direct media coverage of the live events showed how civilians and security personnel fell on the streets and inside their homes on one side of the area. site of the resistance. This was not a clash nor a mini war, as the warlord Zsa Zsa called it. This was a one-sided terrorist attack against unarmed civilian protesters and innocent people who were sniped inside their own homes. From Beirut to the southern Numairiyeh, from Kfardan Zaarir in the Biqaa to Nahran in Al-Qura up north, the martyrs of the ambush of treachery by Zsa Zsa forces in Fayoune offered sacrifices on the altar of their homeland, which the Zionist American project wanted to slaughter with its old but renewed tools. No, we will not be dragged into a civil war, and we will not allow the international and regional sponsors of the aggressors to take the country to sedition, because we are strong and wise. We know how to act and react. We learned the hard way. We don't want strife and sedition, but everyone who lives within the borders of this country needs to take a clear stance with Zsa Zsa and his gang, who operate in the interest of the Americans and certain Arab parties that wants to see the country taken towards sedition. It is not up for debate that the security and judicial services must bear the responsibility and bring the criminals to justice. Any delay in this matter will be considered a partnership in spilling the blood of the innocent. The unarmed protest that aimed at exposing the black chambers whose agenda the judicial investigator in Beirut Fort Explosion, Tariq Al-Bitar, is implementing turned into a massacre. This gives the people more persistence to counter this approach to the investigation, which has now been exposed as being invested in political and electoral schemes. Thank you for turning in for the Mideast Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. The years of imprisonment he deserved did not change him, and the experiences of political impotence and strategic failure did not teach him. He is still, despite the bleak outcomes of his entire destructive biography, attached to his instinct of bloodshed. Samir Zsa Zsa, head of the Lebanese Forces terrorist militia, has proved to be the longtime assassin whose belligerence knows no boundaries. Since his vile nature prevailed, any form of sane human behavior, as soon as his prison gates were opened, he resumed his old habits of slaying. In the face of this instinctive reality, one can argue about Samir Zsa Zsa's responsibility for Thursday's massacre in Beirut. The Tayuni massacre of October 14 of last week rekindles his old foul bets and renews the menace that once led him to prison. The bloodshed in Tayuni was bleakly signed with the killer's name. It drew his features all over the fallen bodies of innocent civilians whose only sin was to take part in an unarmed protest which Samir Zsa Zsa and his Lebanese forces militias did not approve of. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Dr. Ibrahim Moussaoui, member of the Lebanese parliament from the Loyalty to the Resistance bloc Hezbollah. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Ibrahim. All details of the Tayuni massacre were discussed in the Lebanese government and in the Security Council at Lebanon's Ministry of Interior, in the presence of the leaders of all security services in Lebanon, who unanimously agreed that members of the Lebanese forces had started this shooting against unarmed protesters who were all supporters of Hezbollah and Amal movement. In your professional opinion, do you think anyone will pay for this act of terrorism that took place in broad daylight?
Well, again, thank you for giving the opportunity, and condolences for all the families of the martyrs who were targeted by the terrorist militia, just like what you said. It's not a matter of opinion whether we think that this is going to happen or not. I believe that this is a case, this is a cause, this is a very noble issue to be pursued by the by everybody, actually, by the judiciary first, by the Lebanese state. All of the apparatuses, security and judiciary of the Lebanese state should be held responsible for following up the case, and we are going to follow up the case, and we are going definitely to reach a result. It's not a matter of opinion, it's a matter of decision, and the decision has been taken. The bloodshed of our martyrs and the blood of our martyrs is not going to be in vain whatsoever. We're going to pursue meticulously on a daily basis, on an hourly basis, the whole issue till we reach the result that the blood of our martyrs deserve.
Dr. Moussaoui, contradictions that were very risky ones were seen in the Lebanese army statement over the course of that day, where the at the beginning of that day, when the act of terrorism started at 10:45 a.m., just a few hours, or at least 2 hours after that, we read the first statement by the army where it was issued before the meeting between U.S. Deputy Secretary of State for Political Affairs Victoria Nuland and the commander of the army. So before the meeting, the statement said, and I quote, "The protesters were fired upon in the Tayuni Badaro area." Now, the second statement after the meeting with Victoria Nuland said that there was an, quote, "exchange of fire," unquote, which led to the killing of a number of citizens. So which one of them actually happened, and why did they change their narrative?
Definitely the first one happened. The protesters, the peaceful protesters who were marching in order to vent their opinion, they want to exercise their right, their constitutional right in a peaceful protest and to say their opinion about very important issues in the country. They were fired upon by the militia forces, by the Lebanese forces militia, and many of them, we're talking here about 7-8 people who were martyred, and we're talking about more than 60 people who were wounded as well. So this is the narrative, this is the sound narrative, and this is the correct one, and this is what the Lebanese army said in an official statement. This statement yet, however, has to be changed later on after this visit that you mentioned. We're going to go after this as well, because there are two things that happened. I mean, the one that has been mentioned and has been seen by everybody on the TV screens, shooting by the Lebanese forces, the militia of the Samir Jaja militia. And then we had another thing that happened after some interval, which has to do with the Lebanese army.
We will talk extensively about that, Dr. Moussaoui, in the second part of the show. But right now, security services in Lebanon had all blocked the roads and the entrances to Ain Rimani, the area where the snipers were situated in. Now, the night before the sit-in, and they had deployed their forces. So not after the incident. They started deploying their forces since before the incident. And
absolutely,
it was said that before the sit-in in front of the Palace of Justice, the Samir Jaja thugs had been brought from different areas in Lebanon to that specific area, given sniper guns, and a lot of them were actually, this is according to reports coming from security services, information about groups preparing to get violent with the demonstrators. Was this information shared with Hezbollah? And if so, why didn't Hezbollah cancel the sit-in?
Well, there is one thing that is, I'm sure, about everything that you have mentioned, the details that they were bringing people here and there. It was well known for all of the security apparatuses in the country. Yet the Lebanese army and all of the security forces have briefed Hezbollah about this, and they said that they have put, you're talking about more than 1,500 members of the different security forces and the Lebanese army, they were there, and they were blocking all of the entrances to the other part of the, I'm so sorry to use this language, I mean, as if it's different parts. Lebanon is Lebanon, and every Lebanese should have the right to access and to reach anywhere in Lebanon. But, I mean, because of the situation, because of this tense situation, the Lebanese army was there, was deployed, the different security forces were there, and they gave, like, guarantees that we are there with full alertness that nothing is going to happen, and then happened what happened. I mean, I'm sure that whether Hezbollah, had Hezbollah known that this is going to happen, many things would have changed.
Many observers drew attention last week to the fact that everything that happened, from injustice against the Lebanese resistance years ago until Thursday's Tayuni terrorist attack, the leadership of the resistance decided, and finally, if I may, to leave the square of patience, because we as citizens have had enough. But now, as a journalist, I'm asking you, what does that mean? Is Hezbollah preparing to retaliate, and how will they retaliate?
When you talk about leaving the patience square, this is something that I'm sure before Tayuni blood and before the Tayuni massacre is not like at all after Tayuni massacre. Mm-hmm. This is something that should be known for everybody, for the Lebanese and for the non-Lebanese, for everyone who is following up the situation in Lebanon. How is this going to be translated? How is going this to be reflected? In what way? this is something that will show itself after some time, because we're going to give the opportunity for the Lebanese apparatuses, for the judiciary, for the Lebanese security forces to continue its investigation, to continue its work on this. And after that, we're going to build upon it what should be done. The only thing that I can assure you about it, the blood of our martyrs is not going to be in vain. We're going to follow up this till the last moment. And all the perpetrators, all the inciters, all those who shed the blood of our people are going not only to be held responsible, they should be arrested, they should be punished, and they will be punished and arrested.
Mm-hmm. Well, stay with us, Doctor. We will continue talking about this matter, but we have to know who these martyrs were. We are not numbers. We have faces and we had dreams.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
It is one of the country's main parties who committed Tayuni's crime. It is Samir Jaja's Lebanese forces who did it. Hezbollah is now facing a true dilemma. It has to put an end to targeting its partisans in broad daylight without being dragged into the strife that Jaja and his instigators hope for. Samir Jaja, the leader of the Lebanese forces party, and his party is known to be responsible for war crimes and mass murders during the civil war in Lebanon. He was incarcerated for many years because he was convicted of committing two mass murders in churches, assassinating Tony Frangi and his family in their bed one night, and killing ex-Lebanese Prime Minister Rashid Karami. Yet Jaja was given a full pardon by the Lebanese parliament in 2005, but not by the family victims. The specter of Jaja's war crimes hangs over Beirut in this following report.
There was nothing like the sadness of the past few days. Grief for seven martyrs who were helplessly shot by snipers who deliberately shot them in the head. Seven martyrs left scattered families behind. Only their photos remain, and nothing else. While those who survived, they are nearly 30 wounded, bearing indelible scars from the terrorist attack they lived helplessly. Maryam Farhat was killed inside the house she thought was safe, before she died in the armed ambush that snipers set up at the Tayuni roundabout for the demonstration that was heading towards the Palace of Justice. Maryam did not think about her death. Perhaps she was busy preparing lunch for her children before her life was stolen away. Maryam was killed by a bullet that was not reckless, nor was it fate or destiny. It was an intentional bullet fired directly into her head by a sniper. He killed her in cold blood, not caring about five children, the youngest of whom was 4 years old. What was Maryam thinking before the bullet tore through her head? Was she thinking about her children's fear? With their lives in a country on the brink of civil war, did it even go through her head that she would be one of those who would become the martyrs of the Tayuni armed ambush? It is no longer important now what she was thinking. What matters is the five orphans and other children who lost their fathers. Mothers who lost their sons that day in the pre-planned terrorist attack that took place at the hands of the wretched of the earth. Maryam and six other young men, Ali Ibrahim, Hassan Naime, Hassan Mshaik, Mustafa Zbib, Muhammad Sayed, and Rami Zaitir, lost their lives at the Tayuni roundabout. There is no free death in the face of injustice, but death becomes free when the tyrant decides to wipe the blood from his hands with a holy handkerchief that he invented for himself, and he who imagines his legendary self is a ploy to ascend to heaven raised above the skulls of his numerous victims throughout the decades. A tyrant who never ceases to remind people that he cannot live without hatred and blood, and that he cannot imagine a life without power of oppression by killing in various cruel ways. Samir Jaja does that while attributing his actions to a god whom no one knows but him. Jaja only knows how to plant fear in the heart of everyone who listens to him, because he knows no right path, and it does not seem that he will ever know this path. The criminal with a fetish of displacing and murdering people by virtue of his criminal bets and complete foolishness, who emptied the cities of the south and the mountains and their villages from their Christian inhabitants, today threatens to complete his crime and gamble with the fate of the rest of them. And in his planned and thoughtful choice of Ayn Rimeni, where it all started back in 1975, he indicates his desire, and with him his operators, to push the country towards an unknown, or maybe a very well-known, bloody and costly path. Samir Jaja, you shall not pass this time. Hezbollah will not allow it. It is truly a tragedy that happened in Beirut. We are back with Dr. Ibrahim Moussaoui, member of the Lebanese parliament from the Loyalty to the Resistance Bloc, Hezbollah. Thanks again, Dr. Ibrahim, for being with us now. 19 people have so far been arrested for being involved in this terrorist attack, three of whom so far, or maybe more, since the days of the arrest, were found to be Lebanese forces militia men, and one of them works as a security guard at the American embassy. Surprise, surprise. It is clear that both Hezbollah holds evidence about the Lebanese forces' involvement. Otherwise, we wouldn't have heard the heads of Executive Council of Hezbollah, Sayyid Hashim Safiuddin, and later on Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, accuse the Lebanese forces party and Jaja in particular. Since Hezbollah was protesting the judiciary system to begin with, will the resistance trust this same system to solve this new case of violence against its community?
Well, to tell you the truth, we have problems with certain judges. You know, Lebanon is being plagued with corruption. The corruption is spreading everywhere in the different apparatuses of the country, in security forces, in administrative, in cabinet, I mean, in the different ministry portfolios. So judiciary is not an exception. We have problem with many of the judges who have been appointed by certain political parties, and they follow suit. They follow the orders and the directives of those who appointed them, who helped them to be promoted. So they pay homage to them, and they will work according to the agenda of those who appointed them, not according to the national or the domestic agenda of the country and its people. So this is the problem. Now, we have a problem with the with certain judges. I don't want to put the whole judiciary system into questioning and into big suspicion. We know there is a big problem, yes, indeed, but as much we have very corrupt judges, but we have others who are very respectful and who we really work with them, and we know that they are trustworthy and they should be activated and should be helped in order to continue the mission. If we want to issue an obituary to the judiciary, then the whole country, we would lose every faith in the
country. It's also important to shed some light about Samir Jaja, who he is. Maybe people don't really know about him. He is a commander of a Christian fascist militia dubbed Phalangists back in the Civil War, who killed more than tens of thousands of Lebanese. I'm not making that number up. Go look for that number. From Syrians, Palestinians, and Lebanese and other Arab nationalities. Now, when the war ended, he rose to act in politics after he was released from prison by a pardon as a pro-Western anti-resistance figure. So what I mean is that violence is part of his nature.
It's part of his character.
How will Hezbollah deal with this man, and how will the resistance protect its community from his mercenaries?
Well, we know very well when the civil war ended, and Hezbollah has never been part of the civil war. It has always been a resistance against the Israeli occupation and against the Takfiris, but it has never taken part in the civil war in Lebanon. Jaja was there. I mean, in the whole. His history is littered with massacres here and there. To tell you the truth, and everybody knows, if you go to history, if you go to the archives, you will see that he has perpetrated massacres and perpetrated the crimes against the Christian community. He has one single goal that he wants. He wants to subdue others, and he wants to attain more and more, to maximize his political gains. He wants to be the number one in the Christian community. He wants to create enemies.
Who will stop him then?
Sorry?
Who will stop him?
Now the whole issue now, it's in the hands of the Lebanese state, in the hands of the Lebanese judiciary, in the hands of the Lebanese apparatuses. Everybody is waiting for them to enact and to do something about it. When he was pardoned 2005, it was with the condition that he should stop all of these things. Now he returned back to them. I believe something new should emerge against this man, and he should be handled in a different way, starting by the last thing that happened in Tayuni.
The massacre of Tayuni, October 14th. Now, what we want to talk about, which I delayed till this segment, is the CCTV cameras that shocked the Lebanese people here and abroad, which emerged showing soldiers of the Lebanese army shooting at an unarmed civilians in the Tayuni area, killing two civilians in the process. Hezbollah's attitude towards the army has always been within the tripartite of the army, the people, and the resistance.
Exactly.
Will this incident shake the tripartite? And if Hezbollah is wise enough to keep this tripartite actually steadfast, you think that the resistance community can see this footage and just remain loyal to the army?
Well, to tell you that there are two things that we have to keep in mind always. First of all, Samir Raja wanted to draw the whole country into a kind of civil strife, civil war. And this is not going to happen. Hezbollah has put it very clearly. We're not going to be dragged into any kind of civil strife or civil war, which would serve the American and Jaja interests in fragmentation, in partition, and in this dreams of him to have his own state, to have his own enclave, actually, inside Lebanon. This is one thing. The other thing that we should also be keen to keep is the tripartite formula equation that you have already mentioned, people, army, and resistance. One of the things that Jaja wants to swerve the whole attention, why did they release these kind of videos? The Lebanese army has been very responsive in saying that we are going to start investigating what happened and why did this or the army shoot against the protesters. We have to wait. We don't want to rush on. We don't want to jump into conclusions. We have the trust in the army and we will continue to have it. We don't want to swerve the attention, and we don't want to make or portray the Lebanese forces militia as innocents and as to wash their hands from the crime and go to the Lebanese army.
Excuse me there, but because you do have a wise leadership, but what about the public? You think the public will understand that, given the fact
we
that
have
the commander,
we have a wise leadership.
The commander of the army met with Nolland and keeps meeting every week with the U.S. ambassador.
All of the Lebanese commanders, I mean, maybe with the exception of General Lahoud, I mean, and even I can't recall the history, but usually they meet with the Lebanese army. You know, there is a kind of perseverant keenness with the Americans that they want to change the doctrine of the Lebanese army. They want to influence the Lebanese army. They want to put the Lebanese army on a colliding track with Hezbollah, with the resistance. This is not something that we want to help them do. Actually, if this has happened, then this has happened as an independent or as like an individual case, and it should not affect this equation. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, as we are very keen to preserve this tripartite equation, we are at the same time, we're not going to leave the blood of people to go in vain, whether they were killed with this individual of the Lebanese army or with the criminals of the Lebanese forces.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Ibrahim Moussaoui, member of the Lebanese parliament, from the Loyalty to the Resistance Bloc Hezbollah, for joining us. Thank you for your contribution, and my condolences to all the families of the fallen martyrs of the Tayuni October 14 massacre. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East Stream.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
لبيك اللهم لبيك
لبيك اللهم لبيك
لبيك لا شريك لك لبيك
أشهد أن محمد رسول
Hall of Unity.
If you ask me, why do I love you? No matter where you are, we are the greatest ummah. With the beating of our hearts, we are Muslims. La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah. There's no God but Allah. La ilaha illallah Muhammad al-Mustafa Muhammad is his messenger.
In the name of Allah, the first, the one, the last, the most generous, the most merciful. We start with his name. We ask Allah to raise the rank of Prophet Muhammad and his companions. Respected listeners, salamu alaykum.
Peace be upon Rasulullah. Peace be upon Habibullah. Peace be upon Muhammad. Peace be upon Shafi'ullah. Peace be upon Khair Khalqillah. Peace be upon Muhammad. Last of the
There are many nice moments in one's life, and we as Muslims have nice moments in this special week called the Week of Unity. Congratulations on this occasion. You hear the Call of Unity special program in regarding to this week. This program contains different parts. Use the speech of Hujjat al-Islam Barati, religious scholar, and biography of a character has important role in Unity Islamic Nation. Different viewpoint and speeches about unity. We hope you'll enjoy it. The Muslim nations have lots of sources for being united. The main source of Islam, namely the Quran and traditions of the Prophet, call for unity, cooperation, compassion, and sympathy for others, and warns us against disunity and disputes. This clearly expressed in the following Quranic verse, and hold fast together by the rope which God stretches out for you, and be not divided among themselves. Chapter 3, verse 103.
My name is Murtaza Ali. I am from Pakistan. You know that in my country, unity between Shia and Sunni and other religion is not so good. But I think that unity, nowadays unity is so important.
Now, unity basically can have a positive outcome or a negative outcome. How is this possible? The American government, for example, or the Zionist regime, for example, they stand for unity, but the outcome is negative.
In the time of Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, that all the Muslims in that time, they have conflicts among them, but they are one. They were united. Whenever they came to the war against Mushrikeen and Kuffar, they fight as a unit. They show unity.
You would find the Muslimin standing together, you know, which brought a positive outcome presently today, which attracted many, you know, towards this religion of Islam.
I think nowadays the Muslims, they have unity.
The concept of unity is very, very crucial regarding Islam, especially in our society and community prevalent today.
I am a Muslim. Islam I be. Allah my Lord. His word Quran. Muhammad Prophet. Praise be upon. I am Muslim for all of time.
According to the speech of religious scholar Hujjat al-Islam Barati in the previous program of the Call of Unity, unity means the unity of purpose and goal. United people are diverse people, but their goal is one and the same. When they become united for one purpose, they achieve progress and success. That means power in every field. Hujjat al-Islam Barati and the effect of unity.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
Dear sisters and brothers in Islam, dear listeners, in this program, which is called Call of Unity, we are talking with you in another meeting, in another session, in this great opportunity and occasion of birth anniversary of Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, peace be upon him and his progeny. This part of program is concentrating on results of unity. If there is unity in the Islamic world, what could be the results of this unity? We are now talking about these results. One of the most important results of unity is a power. The nation which is unified is a powerful nation, is a strong nation. Nobody can think about attacking this nation, invading them, or humiliating them, or insulting them. No way for this, because they are powerful and they don't let the enemies to think about it even. Then unity brings power, brings a very good situation and a very good dignity for the Ummah which is unified.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah, ilaha wahida.
In the time of Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, in the early ages of Islam, His Eminence, our glorious Prophet Muhammad, first of all brought this unity as a gift for the society. Before emergence of Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam in Arab Peninsula, there was a lot of conflict among tribes, among Arabs themselves. Northern Arabs, Southern Arabs were fighting with each other. Even tribes were fighting with each other. In Medina, before coming of Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, there were two major tribes called Aus and Khazraj. They were fighting with each other for more than 100 years, about 150 years, for nothing, for a funny reason. And the war started because of one camel entered to the territory of other tribe, and they started to curse each other and fight each other, and somebody was killed, and then the war continued. They called this series of wars Harb al-Fujar, means the war which has no reason, has no a good aim or goal. But when Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam entered Medina, immediately he started to make a covenant among Muslims and called it the Brotherhood Treaty or Brotherhood Covenant, and made every one of Muslims brother of another person. And every two of Muslims, couple of Muslims, were brothers of each other. And they made this kind of contract with each other that they will stay with each other, they will defend each other, they will share each other in all issues of life, even their property, even their in the war, in peace, in grief, in happiness, they share with each other.
Subhanallah.